If you love this planet.
Yes. And we do love this planet.
Dot, dot, dot. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. You be well.
Yes.
Okay, you too.
It's been an honor.
Thank you.
All right.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of...
The thrills continue here on KBOO as the Monday Sampler, starting April 14th at 2 p.m., will present throughout the rest of April episodes from The Lives of Harry Lime, starring Orson Welles.
This is a love story. But don't worry, there's action in it. Arab chieftains, international gangsters, and a buried treasure.
Tune in Mondays, starting April 14th and throughout the month at 2 p.m., as the Monday Sampler presents Orson Welles in The Lives of Harry Lime.
But essentially, this is a tale about one of the times I fell in love. Now, don't laugh. I'm not the first man that happened to, or the third man either.
It's The Lives of Harry Lime, starring Orson Welles, starting April 14th at 2 p.m. on the Monday Sampler, right here on KBOO Portland.
Sound was used for centuries as a method of torture. Place someone's head inside of a bell and ring it.
Tune in to KBOO every other Tuesday at 3 a.m. for the Vinyl Pajama Party with your erstwhile host, Brian.
And eventually,
you never know what you will find on your radio / interwebs during the show, but it will be something.
And eventually,
that's the Vinyl Pajama Party, alternating Tuesdays at 3 a.m., only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
What's up? This is Gabriel Teodros, Abyssinia Creole, Seattle, Washington. You're listening to the dopest radio show in existence, Hard Knock Radio.
Hi, this is James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. You checking out my man David D? Get your sponsors together and check out David D.
What the deal, yo? This is your girl, Queen Latifah, original flavor unit, Jersey's finest. And you listening to Hard Knock Radio.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Over the weekend, we heard that there were a number of students here in the Bay Area who had their visas revoked. And what was kind of disturbing about it is that they didn't identify all of them, and they didn't explain why their visas were revoked. But digging a little deeper, we found that many of them had several things in common. Among them, they were protesting and asking and demanding that human rights be applied to the Palestinians. They were protesting genocide in the Middle East. And to me, that omission was glaring. It seemed quite deliberate, and we wanted to dig a little bit deeper. We saw that Zahra Billow, who is a frequent guest on our airwaves, she heads up CARE, which is the she's the executive director for the Council on American Islamic Relations in the Bay Area. So, Zahra, welcome to the show, and your thoughts on this, you know, the omissions and the draconian measures that are being taken by people who just are looking and saying, I want to, you know, bring attention to human rights violations.
Thanks so much for having me, Davey, and for talking about this. You know, what we learned this weekend is it's about 50 plus students that we
50.
Are tallying. Our partners at Manara West, formerly MSA West, have been tracking the both reports from students and student groups, as well as public statements by university leaders. And so it's at last count 53 students, and this is across California, as well as the University of Las Vegas, so Stanford, Santa Barbara, Berkeley, Irvine, San Diego, Los Angeles, Santa Cruz, Davis, and then the University of Las Vegas. There is a lot of fear. And we've been living with that since Mahmoud Khalil, for much longer than that, but it's been especially heightened since Mahmoud Khalil was abducted outside of his Columbia University graduate housing, separated from his 8-month pregnant wife and shipped to a privately owned detention facility in Louisiana. So in the weeks that followed that, Secretary Marco Rubio said that upwards of 300 student visas had been or would be revoked, and that he was looking for every opportunity to revoke more. It's finally hit us in the West, and people are really worried about, one, if their visa hasn't been revoked, how they stay safe, but also for those who've had their visas revoked, what their options are now.
I mentioned that the common denominator, and I'm just going by the few that we've heard, of course, Mahmoud, who you mentioned, is a glaring example. There's the Korean sister, also another glaring example. I'm forgetting the person who wrote the op-ed. These were people who stood up for Palestinian rights. Have you found that the other 50 people are connected that way, or are the excuses used across the board?
So we're investigating the cases and trying to find as much information as possible. Not every person targeted has been identified. So what we're doing is we're looking at also the public statements from the universities, who can't disclose who the students are. And so I would be cautious to say that all 50 plus who we know of were targeted because of Palestine specifically. But what we do know is that they are in good standing with their universities. They had valid visas until they were targeted. And that the administration, unlike prior administrations who were also bad on immigration, is not prioritizing the way it targets immigrants in any reasonable, not that it was ever reasonable, but in any traditional way. Traditionally, immigrants have been targeted if they had fallen out of status, if they had committed a serious crime or other severe issues. Right now, these are graduate students, people who have permission to study in the United States or who recently graduated and have permission to work and are from countries of interest. So that's all we know thus far. We are, of course, concerned that speech is being targeted. And that's where people are scared, is that students who have been inspiring us for the last year and a half are like, wait, me next? Like, what do I do? And Davey, the fear is so deep that so many of the people I'm hearing from are, in fact, U.S. citizens. And they're like, wait, how do I stay safe? And I have to gently remind them that they are the safest, even still, and that their responsibility in this moment will be to protect their immigrant comrades.
Laura, let me ask you this. Well, a couple of things come to mind. One, are we seeing or hearing about students' visas being revoked who are white, who may have conservative viewpoints? You know, maybe they were marching on the Capitol steps and supporting militias, you know, during COVID. Maybe they were cheering on the January 6th folks. Maybe they were, you know, around when the Tiki Talk marchers were doing their thing. Do we know of any incidents like that? So that we would see more than just CARE protesting and bringing attention to this, but we should think that almost every embassy that has standing here would be concerned that if not their students, the possibility of their students being deported. Hence, when I see a press conference, I'm going to see a whole lot of other folks standing around you.
Right. So no, we have not heard of any white European or other Western seeming quote unquote students being targeted. We have not seen or heard of any MAGA students or pro-Israel students being targeted. In fact, a significant concern for safety, by the way, that Muslim, Palestinian, and other students have raised on campuses is that students will often, pro-Israel students will go visit Israel, sometimes volunteer in the Israeli occupation forces, and then come back to our campuses. Dr. Arupa Maria at UC San Francisco has come under a lot of fire for saying, wait a second, why are there former Israeli occupation forces members arriving as students at UC San Francisco? So no, none of those types are being targeted. And so, you know, to the earlier question, even where students aren't, even where we can't confirm a student was targeted because of their pro-Palestine speech, we do know that things that they have in common include the countries they come from, the color of their skin, whether or not their communities are seen as popular or favorited by the current administration. I will say, David, you know, credit where credit is due, that the groups that are pushing back against this are really diverse. You do have groups that have been in the trenches on Palestine for a long time, including CARE, the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, Palestine Legal, our allies at Asian Law Caucus, and of course, Muslim advocates and others. So you are seeing, of course, those groups as well as Jewish Voice for Peace. But you're also seeing groups like the ACLU, who everyone asks about often. And, you know, interestingly enough, as disappointed as we've been in Democrats in their positioning on Gaza, this seems to have struck a chord. And we knew that. We knew that if the Trump administration went too far, unlike when the Biden administration did, that they would step up. And so Democrats have been stepping up, and we've found a lot of partners in this work. I just wish we'd all been pushing back for Palestine starting in October 2023, or really, if a girl's to dream, 1948.
One of the other factors in this has been that there have been private organizations. The one that pops up the most is Canary Mission, mm-hmm. among others, that have gone on campus, have taken down names and submitted them for possible deportation. What do you know about that? And if you can put on your lawyer hat, is there any clapback to that sort of situation? If I'm calling up and, you know, saying, hey, I see Laura was at a protest, and I believe, you know, she's anti-Israel and we need to do something about that. Is there any legal recourse, or is this just a thing where we can all drop dimes on people, whether it's false or not?
Yeah. So let's name some names. Canary Mission has been targeting Muslim and pro-Palestine students for well over a decade. It is so normal to land on Canary Mission that some people would joke it's such a great like matrimonial or dating website because at least you know the people on it are politically aligned with you. That's how long it's been doing what it's doing. There are other groups like Stop Antisemitism as well as Bitar, and they have been doing as you describe, dropping dimes on people for going to protests and for doing things that aren't even as I hate to call it out there, but let's say outside as going to protest. They're dropping dimes on people who are writing op-eds and who are posting on social media. Some other names that listeners should know, of course, are the Jewish Community Relations Council and the Anti-Defamation League, which work not just on campuses, but really more broadly, and have been softly amplifying this culture of snitching on pro-human rights activists, even when groups are targeted in the worst ways, including, for example, when Mahmoud Khalil was targeted, a number of pro-Israel groups masquerading as civil rights groups said, like, well, everybody deserves due process, but he was horrible. It's like, what are you saying? And why are you choosing to be on the wrong side of this right now? And it really is because they would sell the rest of us down the river to protect Israeli apartheid. What are your rights if this happens? Honestly, Davey, they're very limited. The best thing I can advise people is to be really precautious. If you are a U.S. citizen, I expect you on the front lines. If you have the privilege of an able body, job security, and all of those things, I expect you on the front lines. But if you are not a U.S. citizen, then be careful about where you protest, how you protest, what you say, knowing it can all end up in your immigration file. People have taken to things like not taking their cell phones to protest, not posting on social media about their views. Really like managing their online presence so that there are no pictures of them on the internet and they don't go to protests unless their face is covered. And so there's a number of preventative things that people can do. There is little recourse, Davey. Like, you know, we see this all the time in ordinary law enforcement interactions. Your racist neighbor calls a noise complaint on you, and the cops will show up every day. Like, they will show up every day because their job is to justify their presence. And so they will follow right on every complaint.
But they've also put a Karen law in some places. And if you falsely call up people, then that becomes, you know, there can be penalties for that. Among them, wasting, you know, time if you're doing something that's legal. In this case, you know, showing a political stance is not illegal, even if you hold the visa, as far as I know. You know, you would know better as an attorney. To me, that seems very problematic if I don't like, say, the fact that you wear a hijab, or if I come up to you and we've seen a lot of baiting going on. Hey, Dave, you've been silent on this thing about Israel. Where do you stand? I don't have an opinion. Then the next thing you know, well, he hasn't taken a stand. I've seen people, you know, come after, be gotten after because they were silent on Israel. That type of scenario seems to, you know, there's nothing that can be done to contain that sort of action if it's directed towards you.
Do you remember post 9/11 when the federal government rolled out their See Something, Say Something initiative?
Yes.
The thing about those Karen laws is that they are still very limited, and the enforcement of them will always depend on leadership in local law enforcement. Here, leadership in federal law enforcement as well as in immigration has made clear that they are looking for Karens, that they are celebrating Karens, that they are taking Karens seriously. And Karens here are pro-Israel voices, groups, and influencers.
Right, but what if it's false? What if I say I saw Zahra at a protest and you weren't at a protest? What's the recourse to that? Because that's false information.
So if somebody were on the record you know, confirmed lying to law enforcement. There is an actual crime there. But Davey, my word of caution, or the last word of caution I would offer on sort of how we are preventative and how we protect each other, is that we also cannot live in fear, Davey. It doesn't take going to a protest to be targeted. Rumeysa Öztürk, the Turkish student who was abducted by masked plainclothes ICE agents in broad daylight on her way to iftar dinner in Ramadan, had written an op-ed. Like, she didn't go to a protest. She wasn't all out there like every day trying to take over a building. She wrote an op-ed. She was a PhD student at a prestigious university who did exactly what we want students to be doing. She wrote, what more nonviolent action could there be than that? And that's not to say that protests or building takeovers are violent. They are, in fact, not. And so this is where it's like, you can be so preventative, but I actually, Davey, I don't come at this as a lawyer at this stage in the conversation. I come at this as a person of faith. Like, I do believe that certain people will be tested, will be put forward as sacrificial and will be heroes. But there is nothing Rumeysa could have done that would have been more moderate, except not to write at all. And so it's like, the question of like, was I at the protest or not? Honestly, David, in most cases, the person was at the protest, right? And so the issue isn't like false information. There's enough people going to protest, so the people not going aren't the ones necessarily targeted. And this administration, David, like, this is why it was also important that, like, I'm not ready to say that all 50 plus students on the West Coast were pro-Palestine advocates. We don't know that. This administration is looking for everybody and anybody. There is no system to the targeting, and that's what makes it worse than, you know, for so many years we said Obama was the deporter in chief because he deported more people than any president before him. And he had a system, and that's not to say it was a good system, but there was at least a system. Right now there is no system. And so you could do everything right and not go to the protest. Just write the op-ed and they'll still come after you.
Well, there's a few things to that. One, I like to connect the dots.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about people being snatched. And it seems like there was a deafening silence when we saw this happening in the wake of George Floyd.
Mm-hmm.
In places like Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Except it was Black Lives Matter protesters that mm-hmm. were being snatched in unmarked cars.
Mm-hmm.
And we never really followed up on that. We didn't hear too much more conversation. We don't even know who was taken and who was not taken. We just know that people were snatched up. And in some cases, people cheered, you know, that actually happened because they didn't like the protests. So that's one thing. The other thing is this unaccountability snitching. Mm-hmm. So I was involved for a long time with the ACLU when they were dealing with the snitching epidemic, and it came to a head when they put out the movie American Violet. And for people who don't know, what was going on is that law enforcement around the country oftentimes got grants. They were called burn grants, or they were under a lot of pressure to produce names. And so they would go to people and say, hey, Dave, you know, who in your neighborhood is drug dealing? And I'll go, I need 15 names. And because, you know, you, Dave, have transgressed a little bit against the law, we'll give you a break, but give me 15 names. So I start naming off people I don't like. So it's Zara, Zara's sister, Zara's brother, Zara's family. And the next thing you know, they have 15 names. There's a movie called American Violet that talks about this with a woman named Regina Kelly, who we've had on the show and we met. Mm-hmm. And we were down in her in Texas when they premiered this, the movie that talked about this mother of four became victim to somebody who is being pressured to give names. And they said she did it, pointed a finger.
Yeah.
And you know, a bunch of people went to jail. So there's all these cases around the war on drugs. Where police agencies who were getting these burn grants were under pressure to bring, you know, a certain amount of numbers. Didn't matter if they got the conviction to just point them out. And a lot of folks, mainly black folks, were all swept up in this. And so this is not ancient history. This is recent history. You know, it was in, you know, the 2010 or 11 that we were in Hearne, Texas, with threats that if we went there, that we might become targets for this type of situation. And so, I, you know, sometimes we have selective memory. Sometimes things are swept under the carpet or journalists don't connect the dots. But the government, is my point I'm getting at, has long been willing to do these type of violations. And oftentimes it happens to populations of people that we don't care about. So when it happened in Oregon, we didn't care about it. When it was, you know, these things with the snitching on behest of law enforcement, we didn't care about. And now we're kind of, you know, not even giving the full story here. But this is a long-standing problem. And just to conclude, the ACLU is trying to figure out ways in which to regulate these things, because a lot of innocent people were being jailed. They were being disappeared.
No, you're absolutely right. And Davey, even now, right? Like, ICE is deporting people every day, but in many cases, it's working class people from South and Central America. And that's not garnering the amount of interest that pro-Palestine students are garnering. And so we absolutely have to connect the dots, because right now, the pro-Palestine students are a portion of who is being targeted. But this weekend, it was visas for people from South Sudan were being revoked. And so how law enforcement did and continues to do with Black folks is what they will do to South and Central Americans, is what they will do to Arab and South Asian Americans, is what they will do to Sudanese Americans. And if we don't connect the dots, like, it's our loss, because they are, right? Like, local police talks to the FBI, talks to CBP, talks to ICE, and they're out organizing us in some instances, and we need to be better about that.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of what's the word I'm looking at? People acting in silos, and I think, to me, a lot of finger pointing. I always felt that if somebody didn't say anything, there might be a reason for it. Undercover cops don't walk up and announce, "Hey, I'm an undercover cop."
Right.
And some people are in positions where, and I tell them all the time, keep your mouth shut. You know, we don't need you showing up, but they're pressuring me. I didn't show up. Keep your mouth shut and do your work, because you're better in your position being quiet than being out there and then having your position being compromised. And I don't think we've shown a lot of people grace. I don't think we've really tried to explore why some people would be silent and not want to show up at a thing. And now that we're seeing that, we're actually coming up and saying, well, maybe you shouldn't show up. Well, damn it, for the last 6 months, you were banging up on people's heads for not showing up versus really going after people that were the cause of the incidents in the first place. You know, so to me, that's something that I think we should all be thinking about, as to why people would choose to not show their political hand by going to a march. Like, I wasn't going to the marches this weekend. You know, I feel that they're ineffective. And plus, I don't want to add to the surveillance. You know, I don't need to be there. If people do, God bless. But definitely don't be wagging a finger at me saying why I didn't show up. And I think we got very comfortable in doing that to people versus having an array of strategies and ways in which people can work, which I think is a little bit different than, you know, we know that they're going to go after folks, but we shouldn't all be in one basket, if that makes sense.
Davey, this is one of those instances where I struggle, but I try to hold multiple truths, right? Like, if you, a longtime advocate, regular radio host, doing much more than the average person going to the protest, decides that the protest isn't for you, I'm not going to wag my finger at you. And I have to remember not to wag my finger at anyone not doing or not moving out of fear, right? Like when I wag my finger at folks, or if I were to wag my finger at folks, it's often because I'm forgetting my privilege, right? Like I have the privilege of being a US citizen, of working at CARE, where honestly, the more pro-Palestine I am, the more job security I have. And so I have to remember that I'm in a different position, and so I can't wag my finger at folks. That said, right, both of those truths held, we are also in unprecedented times. Like America is falling apart from the inside out, and the resources we have are being sent abroad to murder tens of thousands of people, now probably well over 100,000, and by some estimates it's upwards of 200,000. America is beheading babies with our tax dollars, and the world is watching. And Davey, like, Ramesa wrote an op-ed. Like, she didn't go to she might have gone to some protest, but that's not what the issue here. It's she comes to people's attention because of the op-ed. And so I'm trying to also push our people to be courageous. And so the multiple truths I have to hold is Davey could be doing something awesome, and I have no idea about it, so I can't be judging him, right? And people might have legitimate reasons to be scared, and I don't want to approach them from a place of condescension. I want to call them in. And I want all of us, right, myself included, to be asking the question of what does more courage and more action look like? Every moment that I live in comfort, a Palestinian is killed with my tax dollars. And so holding all of those things is hard, because I feel like a lot of times it comes down to don't judge, or like, why the heck aren't you in the streets? And it's like, can we do both? Like, can we hold people with compassion, call them in and say, like, whether it's in the streets or on the radio or in newspapers, let's all do a little bit more right now. And if Palestine itself isn't sufficiently compelling, the state of our country might be. And that might be why we're seeing more people coming forward now, because like Trump is wrecking the economy and schools and everything else in the process. And so unfortunately, you know, he's uniting us.
Right. Again, a lot of times when there's a price to pay, people pay that price by themselves. Mm-hmm. And trying to explain it away that, well, somebody got killed, you know, in Palestine, so therefore this is the sacrifice you made. Well, you know, my sister got killed up the street, you know, 2 weeks ago, and nobody said anything, and I was down at the police station with a pick. You know what I mean? So the people have their sacrifices. And I just feel that, you know, the real enemy is the state and its various apparatuses. The real enemy is maybe, you know, why haven't elected officials who have resources and the ultimate privilege not been leading the charge? You know, again, I saw you on the news the other night on one of the news stations, and that's great. I'm glad that you were there, and, you know, we have a relation to talk. But damn, you know, everybody else should have been there with you. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? They should have been like, "Ooh, wow, there's 100 people with you," because they're just as outraged. And you can start naming mayors and, you know, and senators and assembly people and council people who in their position have been silenced. And that's a little bit different than Joe Schmo, who is working their 9-to-5 and coming home and just trying to, you know, barely survive. You see what I'm saying? And to me, that's the people that need to be asked, why aren't you here? Why aren't you doing more? You see what I'm saying? Those are the folks. And we often, I think, place a lot of angst on, you know, the working Joe or Jane, who I think needs to, you know, maybe be called in. But man, you know, where are the Democrats? I know you said they helped, but I see you. I don't see them doing the press conferences. I see you, but I don't see them passing and pushing these bills and jumping up and down. And I try to follow them all.
You're right. People, you know, people cheered on Cory Booker for his 25-hour speech, which was not technically a filibuster. And my understanding, and I just didn't have the stomach to watch all of it, is that there was little to no mention of the genocide in Palestine. And shortly after he ended his hollow stunt, he voted to send more funding for weapons to Israel. And so that's not to say that the Democrats have redeemed themselves. They are not who will save us by any means. I have no faith there. But they will fight Trump just a little bit. And that's progress.
Yeah, but I don't even look at Cory Booker with the mayor of Palo Alto, with the congressperson from Palo Alto, if we're looking at Stanford. Those are those levers. Where are those people that have resources that can make these calls and at least, you know, be on the record to say, hell no, this shouldn't be happening? That's right. Where the deafening silence is. And, you know, to the degree of Cory Booker, he becomes a distraction. But he's in New Jersey and he's a senator, and that's great. But what about our two senators? You know, where's Alex Padilla and Adam Schaff to be standing alongside you saying our students in California should not be having their visas revoked? That's where I feel that's a big miss, and they shouldn't get a pass. Hell no, they should get no pass.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And we do have, right? We've got some bright lights in our Congress, in our congressional delegation in the Bay Area. Ro Khanna, Latifah Simon, and even Sam Liccardo, whose district will include Stanford. But there are so many others, right? Jimmy Panetta, Eric Swalwell, Nancy Pelosi, who are unfortunately just not in tune with the electorate, and really not in tune with their obligations as advocates in an era of a human rights crisis. And so you're right, we don't need to look to Cory Booker, but he's just a very visible person who a lot of people applauded couple of days, and unfortunately will be turned to as the model. And you're right, we have to distinguish. Like, one, he's not local, so he doesn't owe me anything. And two, he's not meeting the standard, any standard. And we have to push our elected officials, our local mayors, the mayor of Morgan Hill, as an example. Davey, a couple of weeks ago, there was a really violent hate crime outside of prayer services. Muslims were leaving their prayer services and somebody assaulted an elderly man, and the mayor took weeks to say nothing. Like, when he'd eventually say something, it was so generic and not meaningful, and potentially partially motivated by the fact that he missed a press conference organized by a council member and couldn't make it. And so then he had to say something, and it wasn't worth the wait. And so it's members of Congress, it's also our local mayors, our school board members, right? Like, ours, it's such a low bar to get on the school board that sometimes I talk to school board members and I'm so inspired by ordinary people who get on and do great things. But sometimes I also meet people who are racist, who are not in touch with the First Amendment, who are on our school boards. And so we need to be pushing at all levels and in all the ways. And that's why, like, I, you know, it's like, you're doing so much, Davey. So if you're like, I'm not coming to a protest, cool. Like, I'm not second guessing you, but all of us have to find our place in the movement and keep pushing. And for some folks, that's going to be out on the streets. For others, it's going to be in op-eds. For some, it's going to be on the radio. And others, it's going to be school board meetings.
Right. Real talk. You know, lastly, I appreciate, you know, your wisdom this morning. I mean, this afternoon. The Sudanese students, that caught a lot of people off guard. And what's the reason for them having their passports or their visas revoked? They said it was because their government wasn't doing enough. What does that mean? And what's been your contact with them, if any?
So we have not yet. So it's South Sudan.
South Sudan, thank
it's
you.
It's South Sudan. And we have not yet received any complaints in the San Francisco Bay Area by impacted people. But we do urge anyone that is impacted or that, you know, doesn't know the status of their visa but is from South Sudan to reach out to us or to any immigration legal services provider for an assessment. What we are hearing right now is that the South Sudanese government is refusing to repatriate deportees from the United States, i.e., they are not accepting people that the United States is deporting. So now the United States is like, okay, we're going to deport all of your people, or we're going to revoke their visas. The interesting limbo is if you're in this situation and there is nowhere to deport you to, you either are going to be held in detention in the United States or potentially sent somewhere else. And that's why it's really important to get those visas. Some people have speculated that it's, you know, that the Sudanese government is lobbying for the South Sudanese government to be targeted in this way. But we're going to see disputes like this, Davey. There were a number of countries in South and Central America who initially weren't taking the repatriation flights, and the United States government threatened them. And so that's why it's not just about the individual, it's also about the community. And then it's about our standing in the geopolitical stage.
A lot more to unpack. Zahra Brillo, our guest this afternoon, let everybody know about CARE, how we can get a hold of you, and any marching orders you would give our audience as we let you go.
Absolutely. So thanks so much for having me, Davey. For those who are not familiar with CARE, we are the nation's largest American Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization. I have the honor of leading our office in the San Francisco Bay Area. If people need help with any of the issues that we've discussed, they can visit our website, ca.cair.com. We've got a get help button. They can fill out a form and our legal teams will follow up with them. If they want to get involved, follow us. Just look up CARE, SFBA, or any CARE for your local community on social media to stay in touch, learn about the marches and events that we're organizing, come to Know Your Rights events, and invite others. I always tell people in my own community, I hope you never need our services, but stay engaged with us and invest in us so that if someone you love does, we are there and ready.
There you have it. Zahra Brillo, thank you so much. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
To learn to rise and grow, but now they're told it's time to go. For speaking truth that pushed aside, we won't be silent, we won't hide. Don't take away our visas, let us stay, let us learn. Let's speak truth to power, fill the fire as we burn. We won't bow down to silence, won't be pushed or erased. We rise for every student, every name, every face. Don't take away our
visas.
More than 50 voices, brave and bold. Their rights denied, their stories untold. We stand with them, we won't forget. Their dreams are ours, no room for regret.
For regret.
We got to fight back, no more fear. Immigrant students, we hold you near. Hold you near. Stop the rage, rebuke all the lies. Together we fight until justice flies. Until justice flies. Let us stay, let us learn, let us speak truth to power, feel the fire as we burn. They came to learn to rise and grow, but now they're told it's time to go.
Time to go.
tuned into Hard Knock Radio. Let's get ready to hear a commentary from Reverend Dr. Otis Moses III from Trinity Baptist Church in Chicago.
On Thursday, the Trump administration signed an executive order entitled, quote, Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. This order targets two institutions, the Smithsonian Institution and the Department of Interior. This order states, over the past decade, Americans have witnessed a concerted and widespread effort to rewrite American history. This revisionist movement seeks to undermine the remarkable achievements of the United States by casting the founding principles and historical milestones in a negative light. Human happiness is reconstructed as inherently racist, sexist, and oppressive, end of quote. The executive order takes specific aim at the National Museum of African American History and the Museum of Women's History that is yet to be built in the United States in Washington, D.C. The order specifically directs Vice President J.D. Vance. As I mentioned previously in the 5 minutes, he is an acolyte of the so-called philosopher and anti-democratic promoter, Curtis Yarvin, who believes that some races are built for servitude. And also Peter Thiel, who is a billionaire, funder of J.D. Vance. And it should be noted that he is a South African, Afrikaner. And J.D. Vance has been instructed by the person who occupies the White House currently, but not permanently, named Trump, to root out any American divisive ideology and exhibits that make America look bad. This executive order also seeks to reinstall Confederate monuments taken down during the Black Lives Matter movement. It must be noted, the Smithsonian is not a federal institution. It is a public-private partnership. The majority of the money for the Smithsonian comes from persons like yourselves. The majority of the money for the National Museum of African American History comes from people like us. It does, however, receive money from the government, but it is not dependent on the government to survive. The Board of Regents of the Smithsonian has 17 people, and J.D. Vance is only one person and has no authority over exhibits, the hiring or firing of staff, and he cannot place people on the board. It should be also noted, the National Museum of African American History is the most visited museum of all the Smithsonian museums, with almost 3 million people a year. The reason this executive order was created was to distract all of us from a bigger ethical and moral issue: the incompetence and possible criminal acts of an administration placing military plans on an unsecured consumer app called Signal, and inviting a reporter from The Atlantic on the text thread by, quote, mistake. This executive order was written to get us distracted, just like Three Card Monty from The True Story. The real story is the deeply incompetent men and women who are in positions of power in this administration. They want to erase our history and distract us from their incompetence and lack of qualifications. I want to announce today that if any funding is taken away from the National Museum of African American History, Trinity United Church of Christ is placing the National Museum of African American History in our annual budget. And I am asking those who are part of this village to become a member of the National Museum of African American History for only $25 a year. You can protect Black history. And when people ask you, why did you choose to support this institution, the National Museum of African American History, just simply say, I go to a church that is unashamedly Black and unapologetically Christian. For my final statement, I must make sure that we do this appropriately. in reference to Robert's Rules of Order, that is recorded in the minutes that there is a motion to be placed on this floor at this moment that the National Museum of African American History be placed in the annual budget for Trinity United Church of Christ to be determined at a later time by the people. Is there a motion on the floor? Is there a second on the floor? It has been properly seconded. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of placing the National Museum of African American History in the budget of Trinity United Church of Christ may do so by saying aye.
Aye.
The nays may do the same. And that is my 5 minutes today. Peace.
Bilal Sunni Ali joins the ancestors. When he was born on 13th July, 1948, his parents named him William R. Johnson, by father Robert Lloyd Johnson and mother Lois Ethel Johnson. His name would later become Bilal Sunni Ali, and it would long reverberate in the worlds of black radical politics and music. Music moved him as a third grader, where he picked up the clarinet and later the tenor sax and the flute. Apparently, he had a thing for woodwinds. He started a band when he was 12 years old. His first band was named The Symphony. He and his bandmates said their group played music from heaven. This was the same age when he met a man who wrote detective stories. His name, Gil Scott Heron. Gil Scott Heron later found fame as a forerunner of rap, a wonderful poet, and a singer of considerable range and power. A few years later, Sunni Ali and other band members would form the Simba Drummers and Dancers, where they wore dashikis, or African-style garments for men. His fellow bandmates included Eddie Adinola Knowles and Cosmic Charlie Saunders. When Bilal was 22, he joined the famous Midnight Band, which backed Gil Scott Heron. But he didn't just join bands. As a teenager, he met Lumumba Shakur and Zaid Malik Shakur, and also Sekou Odinga. These were the guys who helped found the Harlem and Bronx chapters of the Black Panther Party in New York. So Bilal Sunni Ali wasn't just a talented musician, he was a revolutionary as well. In 1975, he went underground and reportedly worked for Black Freedom and National Independence in the Black Liberation Army. From his earliest to his latest years, he believed that music was a powerful tool of human healing. Sheikh Baba Bilal Kume bin Sunni Ali passed his last breath on December 30th, 2024, surrounded by his many children, his numerous grandchildren, his ex-wives, and his wives. He was surrounded by an ocean of love. Now he plays music with the ancestors, with love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Hard Knock Radio. Rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
You told me the war is over. While everything's for sale, it's all in a good performance. Yes, you pretend to care. Hide the weapons. It's all for the crowd. You wanna believe so badly that everything was safe. Don't nobody lose a fortune. It works for you. It's awfully loud in here. Cause Jesse still owes his rent now, and Bree is working for 500 cents, and she is still calling collect now. Can't believe in what you say when I see this. Can't believe of the preachers when your whole existence is illegal, while we wash up all the blood of the people,
of the people.
Wash up all the blood,
wash up all the blood,
while we try to build a room for our freedom,
for our freedom.
We build what they destroy. We wash up all the blood, and I can't hear it all.
You're listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland.
Got troubles, I got them too. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for you. We stick together, can say it through, cause you got a friend in me.
Radio Lost and Found on every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
This is Bird Note. There may be no busier bird during the nesting season than a male house wren, because just a day or so after migrating back north from the tropics, he claims a territory and sets to work checking out potential nest cavities. might be a birdhouse, a hollow pipe, an old nuthatch hole, or one of last year's oriole nests. And in each of these locations, the male house wren builds a starter nest. He'll stack a couple of dozen tiny twigs here, several hundred there, and he'll use whatever else comes to hand, or beak, too, from nails and bits of wire to paper clips and hairpins. Anything twig-like to get the job done. The male house wren stays at it until a female pairs with him. She now picks one of the starter nests and takes over construction, building a sturdy platform of sticks topped by a cup nest lined with grass, hair, feathers, even snakeskin. The male's leftover starter nests may discourage other birds from nesting in those cavities. People maintaining bluebird houses have learned to dump out these dummy nests once a female house wren has made her choice. This helps bluebirds find a space to nest, at least until next spring, when that male house wren gets busy again. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Listen to Black Book Talk at KBOO.